Thank you for joining us for another lesson from God's Word. The West Huntsville Church of Christ at Providence is located at 1519 Old Monrovia Road, Northwest, Huntsville, Alabama, 35806. Anytime you're in the Huntsville area, we hope you'll stop in and be part of our worship. Sunday morning worship is at 9 o'clock, with Bible class immediately following. Sunday evening worship is at 5. Midweek Bible study is held Wednesdays at 7.
All right. Last week was 2 John. This week we're going to wrap up the quarter with 3 John. There you go. I warned you last week. So as we did before, we can start by setting the stage, although this is going to be really fast because we're dealing with the same author. So John the Elder, same author as 2 John, same as the same late first century expected writing, somewhere in that 80 to 8100 time frame. The recipient's a little different. Last week we talked about how there could potentially be some question as to how to properly interpret who exactly 2 John was written to. This one's pretty clear. Gaius, a specific named individual. No real question on this one. Length, 15 verses. It is the shortest book that we have in the New Testament by word count. And this one is actually written where it's even more personal than 2 John. And we'll get into that here in a bit. So there's a number of comparisons. One of the first questions that comes up a lot is Gaius. I did not realize, but in the course of the study, found out that it is one of the most common Roman names of the era. So apparently, first century, the name Gaius is, I don't know, John Smith to us. So there are other Gaiuses that are mentioned in the New Testament, in Acts, Romans, 1 Corinthians. Is this the same one or one of those? I have no idea. Could be. They could also, in each one of those, be entirely different people. I can say with no confidence. What we do know is that he's simply a faithful man that John knows personally, clearly appears to trust. And some have argued that that ordinariness is actually part of the point of this book. We'll get into that a little more as we continue on. What we do know is that John is definitely commending someone who, as best we can tell, is not famous. Although, if it's such a common name, I guess it could be the most famous Gaius of the first century, and we wouldn't be able to differentiate that either, at least not by what we're given. We're going to see a lot of parallels here with 2 John and some things we talked about last time. In 2 John, we saw an admonition or a warning to be careful who you welcome. And here we're going to see quite a discussion around hospitality in 3 John. In 2 John, we saw a warning to guard against false doctrine. Here in 3 John, we're going to see Diotrephes, who appears to be abusing authority. We'll get into that, obviously, in more detail. And so the threat is somewhat different. Instead of false doctrine from the outside, it's more of a threat of pride and control from inside. So since we're dealing with a fairly short reading, let's start by flipping over to 3 John. Let's just start in verse 1. The elder to the beloved Gaius, who I love in truth. Beloved, I pray that you may prosper in all things and be in health, just as your soul prospers. For I rejoiced greatly when brethren came and testified of the truth that is in you, that is, you walk in the truth. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth. Beloved, you do faithfully whatever you do for the brethren and for strangers, who have borne witness of your love before the church. If you send them forward on their journey in a manner worthy of God, you do well. Because they went forth for his name's sake, taking nothing from the Gentiles. We therefore ought to receive such that we may become fellow workers for the truth. I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to have the preeminence among them, does not receive us. Therefore, if I come, I will call to mind his deeds, which he does, prating against us with malicious words, and not content with that, he himself does not receive the brethren and forbids those who wish to, putting them out of the church. Beloved, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. He who does good is of God, but he who does evil has not seen God. Demetrius has a very good testimony from all, and from the truth itself. And we also bear witness, and you know that our testimony is true. I had many things to write, but I do not wish to write to you with pen and ink. But I hope to see you shortly, and we shall speak face to face. Peace to you. Our friends greet you. Greet the friends by name. So there you go. It's a fairly short, fairly intimate letter that we find John penning. However, I think there's more than enough for us to hopefully get all of it unpacked here in the next few minutes. So in 3 John 1 through 4, we find an elder unto the well-beloved Gaius. So we have here a very similar note. In both 2 John and 3 John, we find that John's greatest joy is hearing that his children walk in truth. The same phrasing opens both letters, which has to be intentional. How many other letters John wrote this way? I don't know. Add that to the same listing of who exactly we're talking about for Gaius. However, there's a contrast that comes when we get here, and we're going to talk about that here as we go forward. So let's talk about kind of the structure. Let's start by going through the straightforward parts on the surface, and then we'll dig into some of the details. Basically, what we have here is we have a fairly structured accounting of three men in this short letter. The first one is Gaius. We read in 5 and 6, "Beloved, thou dost faithfully whatsoever thou dost to the brethren." You know what? Let's read that from the New King James instead. It's a little more straightforward. "Beloved, you do faithfully whatever you do for the brethren and for strangers who have borne witness of your love before the church. If you send them forward on their journey in a manner worthy of God, you will do well, because they went forth for his name's sake, taking nothing from the Gentiles. We therefore ought to receive such, that we may become fellow workers for the truth." So we read here that Gaius is walking in the truth. He's showing hospitality to travelers, traveling missionaries, even though they are strangers to him. I was thinking about this and how we've gotten today where it's not uncommon, or actually we think it odd, if someone, bear with me, James, knocks on our door. Now, I'll admit, if you live in a neighborhood, that may be more common. I have a fairly long driveway. And in Alabama, you just don't go creeping up long driveways. At least most people don't. Especially not if it looks like there might be dogs or something running around. You've become a little bit inhospitable, James, because people just don't go knock on doors like they used to. I remember a time not that long ago when it was a big deal. I mean, don't get me wrong, people still go make visits, but it used to be far more common. Some of my best memories are going with Arnold Wright, when we were still meeting at the old building to go visit folks who had visited the congregation. One, because if you want a master class on how to visit somebody, the only way I know to receive that is to go with Arnold Wright and make visits. But there's others. There's lots of people. I remember going with Mike a few times to make visits years ago. These days, it's almost like a foreign concept. Someone knocks on the door, what do? Just be quiet, they'll go away. Tommy's laughing, so I know he knows what I'm talking about. It's a meme, it's a joke. And here we have Gaius, who is walking in the truth, and he's doing that by showing hospitality to travelers. He's showing hospitality where he's not only going to answer the door, he's going to feed and care for them and give them what they need to send them on their way so that they have to ask nothing of those they're going to preach to. And it appears that he's doing this faithfully. The word implies consistency. This is not a one-time act that he's being commended for. This is something that he's known for. This is something that John has heard of these good deeds and he's gotten this report, likely from multiple people that, as they're traveling, have made it back to him and told them of how they were welcomed and cared for. In fact, we're told that the missionaries themselves have reported back to John. And he represents what is being commended here as a right posture. Faithful, generous. He's doing what he's being told. And it doesn't appear there's any external pressure to do so. This just kind of appears to be who Gaius was. We get to verse 9, and we see this being very much contrasted with Diotrephes. So if we pick up in 9, let's read 9 and 10 again. I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to have the preeminence among them, does not receive us. Therefore, if I come, I will call to mind his deeds which he does, prating against us with malicious words, and not content with that. He himself does not receive the brethren and forbids those who wish to, putting them out of the church. So this is interesting. The Greek, philopatrudo, I guarantee you I'm saying that wrong, so don't ever quote me on Greek. The word here literally means loves to be first. What I find interesting about this, James, is if I understand this right, that's the only place that Greek word appears in the New Testament, is to describe this person. Loves to be first. We're going to talk more as we wrap this up about how a lot of times we make the mistake of thinking that the church today has got it wrong. We have nothing but problems. I think sometimes people think that, oh, if only we had had John writing us letters, we would have had it all figured out. Clearly not. When I read the description of this gentleman, for some reason I'm picturing somebody who's really worried about how many likes they have on their Facebook post. Because he wants to be first. I get the impression that this is someone who realizes this isn't a race, but they're winning. He refuses to receive John's letters or acknowledge his authority. First, it's interesting that John specifically says, I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes does not receive us. So somehow this has gotten all the way back to John, that John knows that he wrote to the church, and the reason the church hasn't heard his letter is because of Diotrephes. We're even told that it appears he's spreading malicious words against John. He also seems to be refusing hospitality to traveling missionaries. Not only refusing it himself, but also and forbids those who wish to, putting them out of the church. All right, so what do we make of this? What exactly kind of, I'm guessing, leader in some amount of role, whether self-appointed or not, because this person seems to have authority that he's putting people out of the church. So whether intentional or not, Diotrephes has taken on a leadership role in some capacity, whether by election or intimidation, I don't know. but he has enough authority that he's apparently carrying these things out. What I think is interesting is, what does John not accuse him of? Huh? Oh, yeah, he does not. He never actually acknowledges that he has. Well, I heard it over here. What was it? Yeah. Doesn't actually accuse him of false teaching. So 2 John, we have people that are spreading false doctrine that are already among them. But we get here, it doesn't say he's a heretic, don't listen to what he's teaching. It says don't do what he's doing, if you look closely. So what appears to have happened here, bear with me, more importantly, correct me if you think I'm wrong, this person at one point appears to have had sound teaching. But they are now holding to it so dogmatically and so inappropriately that they're being called out. Let's remember, this is being written during the apostolic age. John has written them a letter. They don't want to hear it. Why? I already know the truth. I don't need a letter from John. This person has already decided they can't be taught. They're not willing to listen. As a Christian, this is exactly what a lot of people in the world think Christians do. They've already decided they already know. They don't want to listen to anything. They're not going to listen to reason. They've made their mind up. Nowhere in the New Testament that I read does it tell us that that's actually how we're supposed to do. Who gets commended? People who search the scriptures to see if it's true. If someone comes to you with something and says, hey, the Bible says you need to be doing this. Well, I'm not doing that. Let's go look at that. Where does it say that? Where's the authority for that? Is that what it actually says? Now, is there an extent to that that I may be somewhat skeptical or question it? Sure. If I've already studied. But who knows? I need to go double check. Could I be wrong? Could there be something I need to be doing more perfectly? Yes, is the correct answer. Because I wouldn't be standing here if that wasn't the case. Because at one point I was wrong. And I had to go read the New Testament and I had to study and be taught. And it's the reason why I'm standing here now. That and an inability to say, hey, can you teach? Yeah, there's no reason I can't. Sure. But we all have to be willing to go do that. Diotrephes has already decided he knows it all. And don't you dare try to teach him anything. Because he's going to put you out. Now, not only is he not receiving what's being written, he's holding power in such a way that he is even refusing accountability from John. The apostle. Those who were delivering the word. So this is definitely a different category of threat than what we see in 2 John. And it's one that has been given to us here and is clearly named explicitly. And I think it's one that clearly still exists today. James, have you ever seen a congregation suddenly go down the wrong path because one man suddenly decides he has the preeminence over the eldership? And before long, there is no eldership? And before long, it doesn't matter what the New Testament says or what we've been given in God's Word. It matters what that one person thinks. Diotrephes. It happens today, just like it happened then. Now, I find it interesting, as I started, this is the shortest book in the New Testament. But it still happens, and there's a reason it's still here. I'm going to have to stand right in front of this so it quits going to sleep. Okay. I also think it's interesting that there is a... I'm going to give Diotrephes some credit for a second, James. But bear with me. I'm going to be careful. I'm going to circle all the way back. What have we just read about in 2 John? False teachers. Where there are numerous warnings of false teachers who are already among them. Diotrephes could have started quite well-intentioned of, I have to keep the false teachers out. How do I keep the false teachers out? I'm not going to let anybody teach but me, because we know what we have right now. Ever seen a congregation like that? I have too. We can't support missionaries because our elders can't stand right next to them and listen to them every single Sunday. And we can't risk them teaching something that would be false, because then that would be held to our account. Not according to this. You need to show hospitality, because if they have a good work and you send them on their way, you partake in that good work. So it's entirely possible, at least in my mind, not to be confused with correct, that this started well-intentioned. If you're in a space and you've seen false teachers coming in, this starts as a note, we're not going to give that any quarter. We're not going to give that any place. But before long, even the Apostle John can try to talk to you and you refuse to hear him and you speak against him. It's an easy road to go down in the name of, we can't let that in, or we have to protect it. So it's kind of interesting that when last week we were talking about 2 John, we had all these warnings about don't receive false teachers into your house. Clearly a good principle that makes sense. And we get to 3 John, and Diotrephes has basically weaponized that same principle by taking it to such an extreme. He's using his discernment so well that he's even rejecting legitimate authority and missionaries. He's rejecting the good because he's so worried about keeping out the bad. People use this in other areas too. I can't go teach those people because I don't want to be anywhere near them. Again, Jesus spent an awful lot more time talking to sinners and harlots and thieves and eating in their homes than he did with people that were perfect, because that's not who he came here for. The third person in our story is Demetrius. I don't know why I can't say Demetrius without hearing the silversmith in my head. Pretty sure this isn't that same Demetrius, but I can't prove that it's not. In verse 12, we read, Demetrius has a good testimony from all, and from the truth itself, and we also bear witness, and you know that our testimony is true. Demetrius is commended by three witnesses. Everyone knows him, the truth itself, and John personally. Found it interesting. I don't know exactly how you pull this out of the letter, probably because I can't read it in the original Greek, but I'm told that a lot of scholars believe that he was likely the bearer of this letter, and that this was basically John's endorsement of him. He could also well have been one of the traveling missionaries being blocked by Diotrephes. So John's triple recommendation is really quite emphatic. It's easy to gloss over it, like he's just repeating it, but this seems to be a very deliberate, given Gaius apparently needs confidence to receive him. If he is the one carrying the letter, it's almost as if John is very intentionally giving this recommendation and endorsement of Demetrius, because if these people are in the same place, Gaius and Diotrephes are at opposite ends. Diotrephes was putting people who welcome missionaries out of the church, which means Gaius was likely dealing with Diotrephes having said, you're out of the church. So there's an interesting relationship going on here, but it's definitely a very emphatic support that we find John giving him. So let's look at some linguistic notes. I always find that interesting when I'm studying a chapter. I'll admit, I'll go look at tools and I'll try to look for stuff that's like, hey, what's the cool stuff in this chapter that if I'm reading this in English, I'm going to miss? Because I can't read it in the original text. So one of the ones that I thought was interesting was the word agapetos. It's translated beloved. It's translated beloved in verses 1, 2, 5, and 4. We only have 15 verses. It's the shortest book we have. But we find the same word used four times over and over. The English translation rendered it simply beloved. And it's there four times, so it can start to feel a little bit like a filler or a formal address. But in Greek, I'm told, it carries the full weight in every occurrence. It is the adjective form of agape. The self-giving covenant love John writes about throughout his letters and even in the gospel. John is not being polite or formulaic. He is repeatedly and deliberately locating his relationship with Gaius inside the framework of that agape love. I'll be honest. I didn't realize that until I was starting to do some digging. Because beloved is certainly one of those words that I would have glossed over as it being simply an address or a way to refer to somebody. The next one I think we should look at is the word aletheia. I guarantee you I said that one wrong too. In English, it's translated truth. We find it several times. It's also found in 2 John 4. So, in English, when we say truth, it's very much propositional. It's a statement that corresponds to reality. In John's Greek, this word carries more of a relational and dynamic weight. What do I mean by that? So the phrase peritelo ellen athia means walk in truth. It means something closer to the inhabiting a reality that is ascending to correct doctrine. So this is more like being in truth. It's the truth. It's not just a statement. This is leaning almost towards more a way of being or the idea of ascending to something that is correct. This is the reason why we find John saying that it is with greatest joy to hear that his children walk in truth. They're not just believing things that are true, they are walking in them. They are ascending to that. They are attempting to do those things. This is not just a academic, if you will, acknowledgement of, yeah, that's true. Right? This is more of a way of being. And again, we find the phrase in both 2 John and 3 John. In both cases, the English kind of misses the embodiment, the lived quality of the truth that the Greek conveys. So, see if y'all are paying attention to that point. What's the difference between knowing the truth and walking in the truth? I know it's late on a Wednesday. Yeah. Parable of the two sons. What else? Yeah. One, knowing is just an intellectual awareness. Walking implies an action, right? It's one thing to know what's right. It's a whole other thing to do what's right. It's way easier to know what's right than to do what's right. Another one that I thought was interesting, because it gets used multiple times, is actually the word martreo. It's the word from which, in English, we get the word martyr. It means to bear witness or testify. It appears three times in 3 John. Missionaries testify about Gaius, and John's triple recommendation of Demetrius. So, in this larger context of what John seems to be talking about here, this witness and testimony are among the most loaded concepts in his writing. They run throughout his gospel. John the Baptist as witness, the disciples as witnesses, the Spirit as witness, and his epistles. Using martreo for these seemingly mundane acts of personal recommendation is really... He's quietly elevating them, and I think that's something that we probably miss in the English, because it would be one thing to say someone bears witness to something. I think we would get the context if we said they were a martyr of something. But it's the same Greek root. These are not just mere character references. They're acts of bearing witness to truth, linking everyday faithfulness to John's larger themes of testimony. Let's remember, this is also couched in this phraseology here, really in 2 John and 3 John, around this idea of missionaries, people that are coming through, people that you're showing hospitality to. It's also interesting that the word choice seems to suggest that commending a faithful person is far more than just a social nicety. This is actually a part of one's faith or religion, if you will. This is not just something that you're doing because it's polite. Let's look at one more. John commends Gaius for showing hospitality to Zeno. Strangers or foreigners. It's the exact same Greek word as the one you would think. It's the word we get xenophobia, fear of strangers, or xenophilia, love of strangers. Same basic root. And apparently Gaius is receiving people that he had never met. I think that's what's being implied here by use of this word. And that's where we get this idea that these are not people he already knew. These are foreigners. These are strangers. So I don't know exactly, because I wasn't there, what it was like in the Greco-Roman first century time frame to show hospitality like this to a stranger. What I do know is that most houses, even to this day in the Middle East, have a courtyard with a gate for the purpose of being able to close it up at night. We're dealing with the first century. If something weird happened in the middle of the night, or something went wrong, or we hear a bump, or, James, somebody knocks on the door, you can't pull out your phone and go, yeah, I don't know what's going on, but there's somebody weird at my front door. Can you come check it out? Not an option. So if you think about it, you're putting yourself in a pretty vulnerable place. You're inviting someone into your home who you don't know, and now you're going to go to sleep. Right? I don't know about you, but one of the things that I clearly evaluate when I'm traveling, when I get to a new town, is I get to the hotel and I close the door and I lock it and I lock it and I lock it. This is letting the new town come to you, and you're unlocking it and you're unlocking it and you're unlocking it and you're inviting them in. And that's what Gaius is being commended for. So I don't know to what extent, but I have read that extending hospitality like this to actual strangers carried real social and economic risk. This was not casual generosity. Especially in areas where the church is already being persecuted. I can completely imagine a reality where somebody that stayed at your house goes to the next town, and based on Paul's travels, everybody gets all riled up. And next thing you know, they're coming back to the town going, who sent this guy to our town? And they're looking for you. So it's interesting because the word choice here seems to make Gaius's act more costly and deliberate than simply welcoming fellow believers would suggest. That's my point. I also think that this sharpens the contrast with Diotrephes. Gaius opened his home to strangers on the basis of their testimony. They showed up and said, I know John. This is what I'm doing. This is what I'm teaching. And he welcomed them in based on that testimony. Diotrephes closed the door. Well, we're told even on John. Because he wouldn't hear him and he resisted him. So there's clearly a very sharp contrast here. Okay. I also think we shouldn't miss the point that we're told quite clearly here that the traveling teachers went out for the sake of the name. So this is Christ's name, not their own. They took nothing from the Gentiles, meaning this is being provided to them in some fashion. And let's be honest, I haven't been in a while, but I love backpacking. You can only carry so much food, right? If you're going to go hike the Appalachian Trail, you don't carry whatever it is, 2,400 miles worth of food when you set out from Springer Mountain. You take a week or two, and then you have to stop. And the same thing would have been true here. And we're told they took nothing from the Gentiles because they're finding people who are being hospitable and who are sending them on their way as they go. They were entirely dependent on the hospitality of the believers. And you could argue that even their integrity depended on the generosity of the church. One of the reasons most of the world doesn't trust Christianity at large today is because the only way they see it is on their TV screen, and they want to pray for you if you send a check. One of the things I love, ever since I first heard that it even existed, about GBN is the fact that they absolutely do not do that. Because that sets it apart and makes it very unique compared to what people think of when they think of Christianity. Okay. We've already talked about how John doesn't say that Gaius is merely being kind. He says Gaius becomes a fellow worker for the truth. I think James would support me in this. I think we need to realize that when we support missionaries, we are partakers in their work. And that's an important thing for us to remember. It's not just that we had some act of giving or we gave some contribution or something that they needed. Don't get me wrong, that's important and they need that. Gaius did that as well. But by doing that, he became a partaker in their work. And much like some of the other Greek that's buried here, that's a big deal. Because every one of us is called to help spread the gospel. And I may not be able to go preach in some other land or maybe even in another city. Some of y'all wish I'd do a little less preaching tonight. But I can still be a partaker in that by supporting those who can go and those who will. And that is explicitly stated here as what Gaius is doing by John. And I think it's interesting that that's one of the most direct and pointed applications in this letter that we can see, because that principle has not changed. There's a huge difference that these are practical. They are fellow workers in that work, not mere passive donors, not merely people that were, oh, you did well, not, it was none of that. They are called partakers in that work. When I hear the word partaker, I think of it as being, it is the same as if you were doing that, to partake in something. Right? If a group of folks all go get in trouble, a group of kids run around, all go get in trouble, and they do that, and they're all partakers in the mischief, it's because they were all part of doing it. Right? That's the same type of phraseology we see here. And then we see the contrast with Diotrephes. Diotrephes' refusal of hospitality is not just rude. If Gaius was a partaker, then Diotrephes was actively standing in the way. Now, there's one of those two sides I'd rather be on, James. I'm going to tell you that right now. He's blocking missionaries. He is blocking the name they carry. His inhospitality to truth bearers is, in John's framing, opposition to the truth itself. That's what he is saying here by calling this out. All right. So why do we have 3 John? It's clearly less, I don't know how to describe it, polished theology maybe than what we find in Acts or some other places. It's not a lot of direct commands. It's clearly a bunch of examples. But I think it's here because, well, it reminds us that even in the first century, there were churches that had problems. And not every problem was a false teacher that came in. I think this is somewhat unique in that here we have a problem of someone who is clinging to what they think the truth is almost too hard, to the point of refusing to be taught, to claiming authority that isn't theirs. This letter shows us that we have this network of these what appear to be smaller congregations spread out, helping these traveling teachers as they come through. That still exists today. I think it's also interesting that we see here a dispute over authority, because that still happens today too. And we don't just have a person or that man, he's named. There's places, I mean, we talked about in 2 John where we kind of think maybe there was a name, or it could be, or it might not be, or maybe we're looking at it. There's no question about who these people were. We may not know exactly if it could be other people with that same name that we read about in the New Testament, but we're pretty clearly dealing with 3 people that, at least for the purpose of this letter, were all in the same place at the same time. It's also interesting that it appears we have a case here of someone who was intentionally and directly trying to refute or refuse even apostolic authority. Which I guess kind of reminds us, James, there's some people that no matter how clear, just won't do right. Sorry, did I just quote Andy Griffith? I might have. I think it's also interesting that we see these logistics of hospitality, because there were clearly quite a few of these teachers that were coming through and that this was being dealt with, that this was happening. I also think it's a really good reminder that, as I said earlier, the first century church was not perfect. They had to work through issues just like we have to work through issues. The goal is not in the perfection, but in the striving and the attempting. Man, y'all lucked out. I had some really good discussion questions. And I was really prepared to stand here in lots of awkward silence. All right, I guess you get out of all that. So I appreciate it. Thanks for your attention. I would tell you what next quarter's class is, but I haven't looked it up, so I don't know. Thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed this lesson from God's Word. If you would like to continue your study of New Testament Christianity, please send your name and address to World Bible School, West Huntsville Church of Christ, 1519 Old Monrovia Road Northwest, Huntsville, Alabama, 35806. Or if you prefer, send your name and address by email to wbs@westhuntsville.org.